Now, tonight, Australian time, the big announcement comes. The world's most famous literary award, the Man Booker Prize for Fiction for 2014, will be revealed. And there are six contenders. On the list is our own Richard Flanagan for his marvellous book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which is a love story based on his father and set around the building of the Thai-Burma Railway by prisoners of war in absolutely horrific torture circumstances. Also on the list, the UK author Ali Smith with her book, How to Be Both. A wonderful title, a gender and genre-twisting story inspired by a Renaissance fresco. There's also Neil Mukherjee with The Lives of Others, which is an intricate tale set around a family in Calcutta that's on the brink of change. There's also two Americans in the field, and this is the first time Americans have been contenders for the Booker Prize. Joshua Ferris's novel is about the world of social media, or how social media can be the world. It's called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. And then there's Karen J. Fowler with We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, which explores the consequences of raising a family using theories of human behaviour. It could be one of them. Or maybe it will be the UK author Howard Jacobson, who's already won the Man Booker Prize. He won it in 2010 for The Finkler Question. So can he strike twice with his new novel? It's a post-apocalyptic story called Jay. It's set in a future world still trying to recover from a historical catastrophe, which is presumed to be a Holocaust. Well, just hours before the big announcement, Howard Jacobson speaks to Anita Barrow.
Congratulations on making this shortlist for the Man Booker.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And last time you were shortlisted, you bought your wife a mulberry bag.
We're waiting to see what happens. I've got to win first. So, you know, she can't get anything really mega unless I have the big win. I'm not expecting the big win. You can't be greedy about these things. But were it to happen, otherwise she'll have to settle with for a bottle of perfume or something. I'm quite conventional when it comes to gifts.
Well, my copy of Jay has in the corner long listed for the Man Booker 2014. And I understand that five of the long-listed contenders, including you, hadn't actually been published before it was long-listed. Is that right?
That's correct. And then they rushed it out so that people could buy it, which after all is the object. But all's well now, and now it's shortlisted, and you have a very good Australian writer shortlisted, so there's much tension. Very few people win the prize, and the list of people who've won it twice is, you know, Peter Carey, Kurt Sear, Hilary Mantel. That's a pretty grand list. It'd be fantastic to join them, but I was brought up not to expect too much, and I'm expecting nothing. It would be wonderful.
Well, crossing your fingers. So let's look at this novel. The title is not strictly J. You've made up a new letter. It's a J with two slashes across it.
Yes, kind of silenced and erased and an obliterated J, yeah, which makes it very, very difficult for people to find the book on Amazon and things. So mainly it goes around just as J now.
And can you explain what's behind that?
It's a dystopian novel, they say. It's a novel set in the future anyway, and it's about some terrible event has occurred. It's called in the book, What Happened If It Happened. So it's a book about denial. So very early on in the novel, the hero of the novel, Caven, remembers his father telling him that whenever you begin a word with the letter J, you must cover your lips. In other words, you mustn't speak it. It mustn't be heard. So we're in a world in hiding here. And one of the things that's being hidden is words that begin with J. So, you know, you put two and two together. Who are the people who have been annihilated? The letter J, you get there. And this novel is very interested in the idea, not just of what happens to the victims of such an act, but what happens to those who won, if you like. What kind of victory is it when you remove the people that you felt different to, when you've annihilated, as you hope, all trace of them, as the Nazis wanted to do with the Jews? What are you left with for yourself? What's the price you pay? And this book is partly about the impoverishment of a society that gets rid of its own argument with itself, if you like.
But it is ambiguous, though. It made me ponder on lots of different J, strong J words like joke, jazz,
yes.
Jesus, justice.
Yes, that it works well, actually. Once you cover one J, you're covering a lot of very interesting and related J's. It worked out very well, that, as I saw it pan out. The joking, particularly, because the world that we're in now, this post-apocalyptic world, is a world that can't joke anymore, that's frightened to joke, that's frightened of uncertainty, because it's given away the concept of difference. So it's left with, you know, just conviction and certainty. So it's fearful of anything that might disrupt that, including jazz and jokes.
You do, at one stage, explain the principles of a joke through jazz. Can we just have a little excuse to play some of it?
Sounds like baby patter. Baby elephant patter, that's what I call it. Say, up in Harlem, at a table for two, there were four of us, me, your big Pete, and you. From your ankle up, I'll say you sure are sweet. From that down, there's just too much feet. Yes, your feet's too big. Don't want you cause your feet's too big. Can't use you cause your feet's too big. I really hate you cause your feet's too big. Yeah. Na-dee-woo-da.
So that's your feet's too big, Fats Waller. And this is Caven trying to explain comedy to Ireland.
There is a scene very early on in the novel. They've just met. She makes paper flowers. They're in a sort of tourist village, except that no tourists come anymore because this is a ruined world and there's not much travelling going on. And he carves love spoons. And they make little offerings to each other. It's just this apparently delicate tale, but beneath it all, if you like, or around it all, or above it all momentous things are happening. And this remains a theme with them throughout as she gradually starts to learn just to play a little bit and to understand that, you know, this is an ironical thing and that you can be rude to somebody and it can still be an expression of love. And he sings this to her. He plays at an imaginary piano and he sings this to her. And she's very upset by it because she takes it very literally. And she's never heard a song like this. They don't play music like this anymore in this world. In its attempt to sort of batten down everything, love ballads are played and there are musicals on at every theatre.
Cookbooks and romances.
Exactly. And she thinks he's insulting her. She doesn't get the idea that you can sing a song like this and it doesn't mean that your feet are too big. I mean, there's a little moment he had to explain what jazz was. Aileen had never heard any. Jazz, too, without exactly being prescribed, wasn't played. Improvisation had fallen out of fashion. People wanted to be sure when a tune began exactly where it was going to end. Wit the same. Its unpredictability unsettled people's nerves, and it's unsettled hers.
Because there's only one room for one if, isn't it?
And it's yes.
If it happened.
Yes. If it happened, did it happen? If it happened, then that's enough uncertainty for this world. So it's a world that's kind of paralysed in its own certainty. And to that degree, you could say it's a little bit a book about now. Well, all future novels are books about now, as well as that's a cliche, but it's true. One of the best ways I've discovered to write about now is to write about what's coming up, because then you can look back at what now is. But such things do not exist in this, apart from, you know, in Caven's memory of them, because his father was an outlaw to that degree, in that his father played this kind of music in secret. His father was a person of the old world and had some of the virtues of the old world, which virtues are not encouraged anymore, papers and memories. And also, of course, there are some drawings. He finds drawings done by his mother, and it turns out that they're drawings which are themselves, you would not think there could be such a thing. Can art be offensive to a society? Well, of course, art can be offensive to a society. He himself sometimes teaches the art of carving love spoons at an art college, at a college for the benign visual arts, because everything has to be benign in this world, sinisterly benign. And so he goes to take advice on the value of his mother's art there.
And he talks to the professor there, Professor Edward Everett Phineas Zamansky, who's yes. really actually a kind of Stasi-like spy.
Yes, and we only discover that very, very slowly. He just seems to be, you know, a sort of pleasant enough duffer until little by little we realise that he's involved in whatever plots are going ahead to ensnare Caven and Aileen.
Well, can you read from this section where Caven takes this artwork of his mother to the Professor Zamansky?
Yes, so he shows the professor the work. And the professor says, Caven, look, I don't know when your mother did these, but they are of another time. Art has changed. We have returned to the primordial celebration of the loveliness of the natural world. You can see there is none of that in what your mother did. See how fractured her images are. There is no harmony here. The colours are brutal, Forgive me, but you have asked me, and I must tell you. I feel jittery just turning the pages. Even the human body, that most beautiful of forms, is made jagged and frightful. The human eye cannot rest for long on these, Caven. There is too much mind here. They are disruptive of the peace we go to art to find. You make me proud of her, Caven said.
Howard Jacobson reading from Jay, a novel here on Books and Arts Daily. So art finds thoughts. This is the warning, isn't it? It's our biggest danger, because I'm reminded immediately of Hitler very early on in his career. He enforced his own artistic values on Germany.
Yes, and you're meant to be, and you're meant to think of that exhibition of degenerate art that the Nazis put on, in which the Jews were shown as purveyors of this vile, disfigured art, and the language that Professor Edward Everett Phineas Zamansky employs is very much the language of those who put on that exhibition of degenerate art. And it reminds you that while we might sometimes think that art is sort of marginal to our political life and not really, you know, not just one of life's pleasantries, one of life's indulgences, if you like, that it is not the case, and that it is through art. I don't have to tell you this on a book show, but that it is through art that we express some of our deepest feelings and our deepest concerns, and register particularly their dislike of different groups of people through the art that they make. And what I want the reader to hear there is not only echoes of what the Nazis were saying about art. And that was the reason for having, right at the start, this Professor Edward Everett Phineas Zamansky having his own diary, so that we could hear this voice echoing through time, really, as many of the voices echo through time here, saying things about the people who have been destroyed through their art, which should remind us of the reasons in the past that have been given for destroying people. It's an odd one, isn't it? Let's destroy them because we don't like the art that we make. That's not how we put it, but that's partly what's going on. We do not like the way their sensibility.
And as you say, this is about an imagined future as a way of expressing the reality of now. So you clearly have concerns about what is happening now. What are the deep concerns you have?
Oh, well, I mean, I fear answering that, because then we'll end up being political, and I'm sort of determinedly a non-political animal, although I have political dreads. And people do say to me, you know, this terrible thing that you say has happened, and it might have happened to people whose name begin with J, or it might not. Do you really fear it? And then I have to say, well, this isn't a novel of warning, and it isn't even a novel of prophecy. Given what has happened, there's no reason to suppose that anything might not happen again. And given what has happened, then it happened. And to a degree, it is still happening. We are in, I remember Margaret Atwood, when she was talking about The Handmaid's Tale, and people said, well, will there really be a world in which women will be treated like that? And I think she said something like, well, given the way women have been treated and the way women are being treated, there's nothing hyperbolic about this. There might be something metaphorical about it, but it's not hyperbolic. It is now. Dystopia is now, if you like. I think that. Is the Holocaust over? I mean, not many weeks ago on the streets of London, people were invoking Hitler again and talking about gas ovens again. Has it gone away? Has it really gone away? But anyway, I don't want to go down that route. I'm just sort of, this is a novel that takes it as kind of understood that a terrible thing can happen because a terrible thing has happened.
And there's a collective moral hypnosis about what has happened, if it happened. For your own good, people are told, danger lurks in nostalgia.
Yes, there's no past in this novel. That's to say, there's a lot of past in the novel. The past keeps welling up. Some of the writing I enjoyed most, some of the writing I think's best in the novel, is about the way the past keeps welling up. Nobody knows whose past it is. Whose memories are these? These are the little evocations, flickerings, dreams, even of pogroms and massacres past, just suddenly appear in the book. That's, if you like, against the will of this society, which wants no memory. Libraries have very little access to the past. Without wanting to sound solemn about it, I feel, you know, one could talk about our own, the world we live in today, as one in which the past is getting murkier and murkier. It seems to me that we forget quicker than we used to forget. I used to know when I grew up, I somehow knew all the people that my parents had sort of found amusing or sung songs to. Now I feel each generation wipes out the generation before much more quickly. And this is encouraged by, you know, our technology so engages us in, so binds us in the now, that the yesterday just feels not worth knowing about. We are losing our memory, I think.
And yet, in this book, in this novel, everyone's sorry. They're sorry. And it's, is that also a way of forgetting the past? It sort of releases, as you say, the apologist into an unimpeachable future.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, we say sorry a lot. And the assumption is that somehow or other, once we've said sorry, that's all right then. I've never quite got the saying sorry thing. We often hear people say, if only they'd say sorry, at least that's an acknowledgement of something. Well, maybe, but this is a sorry that doesn't acknowledge. This is an automatic sorry. You say sorry about anything. You know, you mistreat somebody close to you and you say sorry almost at the moment of mistreating them. And then you go back to mistreating them again. Mere remorse isn't enough. The mere act of remorse isn't enough. If you don't know what it is that you've done or why you've done it or why you might do it again, what's an apology worth?
And also you can't take responsibility for it.
Exactly, exactly. As though it was done by some this other self that you can, you know, on the one hand apologise for and then go on and do it again.
And this is very pertinent, I suppose. For us in Australia, we've had a very moving apology from a previous Prime Minister about our dark past in the treatment of first Australians, but also, I guess, the Holocaust too. Do you think, you know, we are forgetting or we're not taking enough responsibility for that past?
I think we are certainly forgetting, and I think denial is, there's something terrifying about denial. It has its own power. There's a kind of exultancy of denial that you see, and we've seen it, you know, on the streets of Europe in recent months. And I remember being in Australia when I've lived in Australia often, and I absolutely understood the necessity, and I could see that there was a great deal of relief when those apologies could be spoken. But you do then wonder, well, you know, the apology spoken, now where are we? What now is achieved? You know, what's the next thing? Sometimes the apology takes the place of a proper restitution, but also a proper understanding of what was done. Here, you know, we all say never again about the Holocaust. And look, less than 50 years after the Holocaust, I mean, just an eye blink of time, people are invoking it again. How many people and with what degree of seriousness, one doesn't know. But that anybody could be invoking the Holocaust again, that anybody could be saying Hitler is right, and anybody of sound mind could be saying that, is pretty frightening.
And Howard Jacobson's book is called Jay, a Novel. It's published by Random House. It does sound fantastic, doesn't it? Really worth reading. He was speaking there to Anita Barrow. And Howard is one of six authors on the shortlist for the Man Booker Prize. And tomorrow here on Books and Arts, we'll know who the winner is.